Hello and welcome back. It has been a while, but I am finally back with another episode, and it's been a weird year for all of us, so I am not going to go on about the reasons why there's been a delay. I'm not even going to apologize it for it, because I think we're all well aware of how messed up this year has been. But I am back focusing on some of my own projects, and this is a banger of an episode, which, funnily enough, I recorded like over 6 months ago, 9 months ago maybe, between 8 and 9 months ago, with the wonderful Dan Lesak. And between switching jobs, getting a new computer, and trying to catch up with everything that has happened the past 2 years, it kind of never came out. And now here it is, and hopefully it's the first of many more podcast episodes to come. So I really, really hope you enjoy this episode. If you don't know Dan Lesak, then do some research. Absolute legend, not just from the stuff he did with Dan Lesak versus Scroobius Pip, but also the stuff he's done elsewhere and the amount of stuff he does and his outlook on being able to carry on making his art and being able to move things around so that he can keep doing what he finds creative and what he enjoys is really, really refreshing. I really enjoyed not only having these conversations with him all those months back, but actually editing the episode and re-listening to the conversation really helped me. It's something that I think, although it was a conversation we had a while ago, is completely relevant today. And finding ways of being able to focus on what you actually want to be doing and not get distracted, having conversations that remind you of the importance of doing that, those things are really, really important, more now than ever, really. So I really do hope you enjoy this conversation as much as I did. I hope you find it encouraging. Like, subscribe, depending on where you're listening from. Leave me a comment. Leave me a review wherever you can. It all really helps. And without any further ado, here is my conversation with the absolute legend that is Dan Lesak. So how have you been finding being in isolation then?
This is normal. I've worked from home for like 15 years. My partner lives in America. So yeah, nice. This is normal. I kind of miss those few interactions I'd have in any given week. But
of course, yeah.
Like, it just means I've spent a bit more time talking to, I don't know, people like my parents and stuff. I've actually been picking up the phone.
It's a strange situation because my partner and I were freelance for 5 years before this. So for us, it feels so normal to be stuck indoors because it's what we do anyway. But seeing the world burn from the outside, everyone else seems to find it so difficult. Mm. So we almost feel guilty for feeling like it's a normal situation.
I think if we can find a way to feel guilty, we will. I think that's part of being a human, sadly.
It's true. So I'm guessing this, you've been working on a lot of music. I know you just released an EP.
Yeah. That was the last couple of months' work. I kind of work in that way. Get it done, get it out as quickly as possible. Got very tired of the music industry. Like, hey, wait every 2 years and release an album. It's like, yeah, no, that doesn't work anymore, guys. That's not a thing we should be doing. So, yeah, a lot, really. I'm about to take not a break from writing music, but a break from releasing it, because if you release too much too quickly, it gets to be a diminishing return.
Yeah, absolutely. I loved a tweet you did the other day. It was actually a reply to your own tweet saying, if you dislike musicians blithely promoting the noise whilst the world burns, feel free to mute or unfollow. Yeah. I think it can become, you can feel like you're trying to push it down people's throats a bit with social media, can't it?
But like, that is, for the majority of musicians now, the only way to get heard. Like, music press is kind of dead. It's pretty much got to that point. There's a reason why MTV no longer features music on it, on its channel, because there's no way of generating ad revenue from that. And yeah, so you kind of have to. I've talked about it a lot online, actually, that I'm not good at relying on social media because I can't tweet about it every single day. Like, a week after a release, I usually have like little clips to share and all that for a week. But in a month's time, it's going to feel really odd going, hey, have you checked this out that happened a month ago? But if you don't do that, no one's clicking, you know? It doesn't work in that way. Unless you've got like loads of clout or loads of external energy coming into your work, i.e. actual radio play, actual press, then you have to over and over again. Because every time you do it, someone clicks it and goes, oh, that's good, that I'm gonna buy that. That's wicked. Yeah,
it's a really difficult situation, I find, because I'm very similar. If I'm not working on something new and if I haven't got something to say, I don't really like posting about it over and over. I find it's very self-indulgent. But I think that at the same time, people who are quite self-indulgent and like talking about themselves a lot and do post about things for years that they've done, actually it works quite well for them. I just personally can't. I don't like working like that.
But like, as we ever being encouraged more and more to think of ourselves as brands, then like, if McDonald's can advertise the Big Mac every 3 days on their Twitter feed, then you can advertise your art. It's fine. You're allowed, you know.
Exactly.
Big Mac's pretty old now.
Do you find, though, the process of having to advertise your art constantly takes away valuable time from your creativity, or actually almost stumps the creative flow that you'd otherwise have?
Not valuable time, because I think you can't be creative 24 hours a day.
Yeah, true.
It's stupid to do it. Your creativity is a sponge that you fill up by doing other shit, whether that be Netflix or movies or talking to people, and then you squeeze that sponge to let it all out. So you can use some of the filling time up on doing your marketing and your admin. I'm going to be doing a bit of a spreadsheet in a minute. That's a thing. Sorry, I'll mute that. I've got to do some accounting and stuff. But it's the energy. Like, it can, because it is, maybe one person does click through that link and listen to your podcast or listen to the album, it can deplete just that sort of drive you have, because you know how frustrating it is.
Yeah,
that's the bit that gets in there. Not that it's like useless, but it can feel a little bit like you're just screaming into the void sometimes.
I completely relate. Have you found a way to combat that, to kind of ignore those feelings or translate them into something positive?
No. Usually it'll be, I will just try to make a joke of it. Try to find a way, because I make a lot of jokes in life. I'm not like a funny man, but I can be funny. So I tend to just try my best to enjoy it, so that also, if I'm cracking wise about it, the people who have been kind enough to click the link get something out of it as well.
That's, you know, it.
They get to laugh at me while other people get to hear my art.
It's true, but I mean, it's the online's a very strange one, because we're always comparing statistics, and sometimes if you translate those statistics to people in a room, it wouldn't always feel so bad. If you take all the tweets you put out in a week and you translate it into one gig, you'd actually be like, oh, that's quite a lot of people in one room. But because we're looking at individual tweets and analysing those statistics, it can seem like it's not really worth our time.
Well, you do have the option of not looking at the statistics. I don't. I've been running the Falling Forward podcast now for more than a year. I don't know how many people have downloaded it.
That's great.
I've never hit the insights tab in Acast. I think Pip knows, because Pip, it's on a network of strings, so I think he knows how many it's got, and he didn't say, yeah, Dan, just quit, mate. So it must be all right. But yeah, just it, if I start thinking about the numbers, then I might not do it. If I found out only 10 people were listening, I might not have that energy to spend 2 hours sitting down talking to someone and 5 hours researching that and another 3 hours editing it all, you know?
I completely get you. But at the same time, I mean, podcasts are an interesting one because you've had some amazing conversations on the podcast that I'm sure, regardless of statistics, have their own intrinsic value.
Well, that was the point of the podcast. It was nothing to do with, air quotes, creating content or anything like that. It was for me to get out of this little isolated bubble that I live in, you know. Yeah. Like, that's the funny thing. Like, we're all in isolation at the moment, and I was aware of my own isolation a year ago, you know. The reason I started a Twitch stream, like, 4 years before that was, again, trying to just get out of this process of not talking to another human in the course of a day. Part of that's by choice, though. Like, I don't like other humans. They're usually dickheads.
It's true. I can relate a lot. And I can relate to all aspects of that because I started the podcast for a very similar reason. I felt like I'd lost some skills in talking to people. I'd been brought up in a very religious household, with public speaking being a big part of that. And as a teenager, when I left that, I felt like I'd lost some skills in public speaking that I needed to get back because I didn't like talking to people anymore. Mm. Generally, I felt that most people piss me off quite easily.
Yeah, I understand that.
But anyway, let's... I actually, the first time I listened to your music was a friend of mine took me to watch yourself and Scroobius Pip back in 2008 at Mr. Kipps in Poole.
Nice.
So it's been a long journey that I've followed you do all these awesome things, and you've done so many aspects. Like, you've done music for video games, you've got the podcast now, you teach photography. Has there been a specific aspect along the way that you've enjoyed unexpectedly, almost something that you found you love along the journey?
I don't know how to answer that, really. Like, I think I work on the premise that I'm going to find something unexpected in the day, each day, anyway. Like, whether that be a new way of making a noise or something deeper. So, yeah, no, I don't know. I didn't realise how much I like admin.
That's like a really interesting answer.
Like, there's just something really cathartic about a nicely formatted Excel spreadsheet.
Should you have been an accountant? Is that the answer to all of this?
I worked for an accountant for the year before Dan and Pip.
Oh, really? And
I walked away from, like, a proper career. I was a graphic designer for a global accountant. And I walked away from, like, a proper career that was going to pay me tens, if not eventually hundreds of thousands of pounds a year to go play a 50 quid gig in Watford with Pip, supporting, like, 8 people, then Kate Nash, for a album launch or a signing party or whatever. But, yeah, no, there's just something, like, the last couple of years of Dan and Pip, we... parted ways with our manager, not in any bad way. She was working as a agent as well. She is an agent now, but and it was just taking her a lot of time. So I ended up just dealing with all the admin crap while Pip played on his phone, I think. there's just something nice about it.
Like, you enjoyed it.
Yeah. It's just, I suppose it's just a thing that has an answer. I'm going to put all these numbers in and I'm going to get a result. And maybe with music, you don't always get as defined or instantaneous a result.
Did you ever think about providing that service for other bands? Did it ever cross your mind?
Weirdly, if I had thought about it properly when me and Pip ended, I should have got into like tour management. Because I can drive and I can talk to promoters about why there isn't any green tea in the dressing room. I can do that. The only thing is to get in to that bit of the industry, you generally need to either be able to do front of house sound, lighting, or monitor sound. And they were all things I wasn't actually well enough versed in.
Yeah.
They're like a skill, because no band, no tour manager gets to just be a tour manager until they're with a band that are huge. Yeah. And you don't get to be with a band that are huge without being a jack of all trades for a small band, you know?
Yeah, of course.
So, yeah, I didn't really think about it. And I was pretty grumpy after the end of Dan and Pip, so I just played video games for a year in my house and going, this is probably a bad idea.
And what about the journey into making the video game soundtrack? You already enjoy video games. Was it quite an easy transition to make?
Not strictly easy, because the two I've done so far, Subsurface Circular and Quarantine Circular. Quarantine, particularly, there was a brief. Like, Subsurface was a little more do what you want, within the bounds of the game, you know. Like, a lot, it's really diverse in genre, because a lot of the music is actually people on a train listening to their Walkmans, so like,
oh, wow.
Like kind of built different characters. And it's funny because it sounds really tinny until you talk to that person, then you hear the full track.
That's amazing.
Which is kind of nice. But Quarantine Circular was very much about story beats. It was very much about this. It's 7 chapters, I think. It's weirdly about an alien coming to Earth and being quarantined and us trying to work out if he's friend or foe and all that stuff. It's very much almost like a choose your own adventure. But yeah, so writing to somebody else's mood was a challenge. Especially as like where I took influence from for some of it was completely the opposite to what it was used for, which was kind of cute. And the other thing was like the actual mechanics of it. Like I was writing 3-4 minute pieces to fit, but because it was a text-based thing, like lots of beautiful graphics and stuff, but the mechanic was reading the conversation, you're bound to how quickly or slowly people read.
Yeah.
And we built it with a structure that the drums wouldn't come in until a certain point in the conversation. So we had to kind of build these loops that could be then switched out for a different loop without it going out of time or out of key. It was kind of, yeah, learning that side of things. And again, there's like a bunch of skills that go with game soundtracks and just game audio in general that I don't have yet. Like the special effects side of thing is a whole other skill altogether. But yeah, no, it's super interesting.
And was that your first time working to a brief, making music to a brief?
Kinda. Yeah, I'd done a few bits. Like, I'd been commissioned here and there to do some stuff for, like, adverts and things. But
yeah.
9 times out of 10, when I was with doing the Dan and Pip stuff, I was fully aware that I didn't really want to do advert stuff. But at the same time, that I should really not burn these bridges because I might need them one day.
Of course, that's just, yeah, you need to be business savvy with these things.
Yeah, so, and usually when someone comes to you offering you an advert, but a commission to do something for an advert, there's usually what they call a studio fee, which essentially is make the demo for however much, a few hundred quid or whatever. So I'd always aim just to get the studio fee rather than trying to get the full advert.
Yeah.
You know? So But yeah, there's challenges to it. But I don't like commissions, but I will do them because without them, I don't get to make art, you know? Like, it's a silly thing, but a commissioned piece that someone like the average person might never hear will generate me more rent than my actual music.
Of course. Yeah, no, I completely get that. Is there any part of you that would ever want to just focus on the music that makes money? And or do you feel that your creative output is what fuels the rest of it, kind of thing?
Well, the aim of the game is to find a way of the art being the thing that makes the money.
Yeah.
So, like, where I am at musically now is a lot more soundtracky, is a lot more atmospheric and all that. So if I can find people who want that, then I'm down, you know?
Of course, yeah. Of course. It's a really interesting transition to make, what you've mentioned from the end of Pip to the twitching, which I'd love to talk to, because I love I know that you stepped down how much you were doing Twitch, mm-hmm. but it's a really interesting period. But it's an interesting transition getting back to releasing your own music and finding that creative balance, I guess. Did you struggle to have your own sound? Was there any part of you that wanted to completely separate it from the sound you'd used with Pip?
That's been the process of the last... So the last time we wrote and recorded together was 2017, and it's taken me till the end of 2019 to really feel like I made a record that bears no, I can't say no resemblance, because there's certain things I'm always going to do in music. There's certain intervals between notes that are always going to resonate with my ears.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's the first time I filled the hole left by Pip. I did an album called 63 Days, which took 63 days, in 2018, and that was almost there, but there were still definitely moments on that where I felt like if it had had that top line as such, it would have been better. Whereas, yeah, with the three EPs, there's no room. I've filled all the space that I needed to fill.
And do you think that filling of space is down to the instruments you're using or the synths you're using, or more down to your headspace?
That's hard to say. I think it's both. I think because a big part of what I'm doing is a different... Although I could make Dan and Pip records the way I'm working now, I'm not using a computer nearly as much. There's a lot of stuff happening live, being recorded and then edited, rather than the sort of meticulous laying of out of something in advance.
Yeah.
So I think part of it is knowing the process is different, and part of it is the pride in achieving some of the things like I'm doing. The weirdest thing about it is the music might not sound like live music, but it's far closer to what I was doing with Dan and Pip live than it is with what I was doing in the studio.
That's really cool. And what about, because you've got a lot of experience, I guess, working analog with real instruments and digitally, is there a difference to how much you enjoy the processes in both?
Kind of, yes and no. Like, it's for me, it's finding a way to make things do what they're not strictly designed to do. And that's what I did before I had a computer. I didn't get access to a DAW, so like Ableton or the music creation software. I didn't really get access to anything that could handle virtual instruments or anything until my 20s. I'm 41 now. I borrowed some money off my flatmate at the time to get a laptop. Like before that, I just had four tracks and a guitar, or like for a while I had an Atari ST. You know, so I've always been about trying to make sounds that the equipment wasn't designed to do. You know, and there are ways of like manipulating things to sound like something else. I've always enjoyed that.
Yeah.
So I think that's always been the process, whatever I'm using. But I've forgotten the question.
It's comparing the digital to analog. And it's interesting because, like, what about buying a new VST compared to buying a new synth, for example? What excites you more?
So, okay. Like, I think the difference is how hands-on things are. Like, when you buy a new synth, you are there straight away. And everything, a good synth, everything's laid out in front of you. And you can really learn it far quicker than clicking with a mouse.
Yeah.
That said, what VSTs have the power to do is kind of mind-blowing. And weirdly, it's actually iOS apps that are doing like the full-on progressive moving forward innovation of music creation. There's like synths like Borderlands, this crazy granular synthesis engine on iPad. Endless, the multiplayer music app on iOS devices, and I think desktop soon. Like they're pushing like boundaries where the traditional VST makers can't push because they've got to fit within the door. You know,
they've got
to fit within mouse clicks rather than multi fingers. And physical synths can't quite do because it's cost prohibitive, you know?
That's the thing. And it's really interesting because the price is coming down. I just picked up the Monologue, the Korg Monologue. And I would have never, like, a few years back growing up, thought I could get a synth that could do that. That was an analog synth for that kind of price.
Yeah, so that's the thing. I've got a Korg MS-20 in my house from... I bought it years ago. And the Monologue... It has a very similar filter and very similar oscillator to that. It doesn't have the little mini patch bay, but I genuinely believe the Monologue is a far better, far more versatile, far more beautiful synth than this vintage synth that you'd have to pay 1,500 quid to buy.
That's crazy.
And you've paid, like, what, 200 quid for a Monologue?
Yeah, 230 quid, I think it is. Yeah, something like that.
And you can put batteries in it and take it over the park if you want.
Yeah,
you
know? It's crazy. It's crazy.
Like, I'm a firm believer in this. It isn't what you're using, it's how you're using it. Like, yes, if you have... $3,000 to spare and you want to buy like a crazy Waldorf multi-purpose synthesizer, then do it if that's what you think you're going to make the best use of. But you can spend 200 quid on a Yamaha CS and make some of the most beautiful pad and kind of just lovely synth sounds. You can make the Blade Runner soundtrack for 200 quid now, basically, is what I'm saying. But the synth that it was made on costs you more than $50,000. So, yeah.
I guess it also depends on what the end goal is, like if it's performance or for just delivering an end product.
Yeah, but I always think that if you spend money on your live equipment, it should just be about the reliability and ease of use.
Yeah, that's true.
I know some people who will spend $3,000 on a guitar because of the look. It looks right. It gets across my personal brand. It's like, yeah, but you could have spent 500 quid on a bog standard telly and it still sound as good.
With gigging especially, because stuff breaks so much and sometimes it is better just to go for something that you know can easily be replaced and can be fixed quickly, as opposed to something that sometimes the rarer you go, the more difficult it is to get sorted.
But that's the funny thing, like, the stuff me and Pip spent money on live, like, the majority of stuff I was using was relatively easy to replace and not crazily expensive. Still expensive, but not, like, insane. It wouldn't, if it broke, we could get a new one and it not hurt us too much.
Yeah.
But the stuff we spent money on were things like DI boxes. I think I looked at it recently, and we used to carry basically 12 DI boxes with us, and we had spent 1500 quid on them. They literally do nothing. Like, the majority of people don't even have never heard of a DI box. All it does is make sure your signal's not too hot. That's it. It just makes sure that the sound man has got something nicely balanced to work with. That's it.
Just addicted to buying them.
Yeah, but if you turn up to a venue and they haven't got any DI boxes, it makes the show infinitely harder to do.
Yeah, yeah, of course. And getting back to the Twitch period of time, how intensive did you find the workload you had to put into that?
Yeah, if you want to make a living on Twitch, you have to do it every day. You have to do it for multiple hours every day. It's not Twitch and the Twitch community, this isn't an event for them. Like, musicians coming onto Twitch feel like, well, I'm on here, this is a bit of an event, this is a treat for you all. Yeah, there's 80 odd thousand. What time of day is it now? It's like one. So there's probably 55 to 60,000 people streaming right now on Twitch. Like, if you're not on, then somebody else, they're going to just watch someone else. Like, people aren't going out of their way to come and watch you. They're watching you when they watch Twitch. So, yeah, you build because you're there regularly. At the same time, more than because you're somehow special and wonderful. Yeah. So, yeah, when it was paying my rent, and it did for a while, maybe a year or so, it paid my rent. It was definitely, I was streaming 50 hours a week, and it was great fun. It was definitely fun, and it was nice, and it does kick some dopamine in when you something fun happens and chat goes wild and all of that stuff. But the reason I started it was to get myself out of a depressing spiral and get back to making music. And yeah, it was then stopping me making music because I was spending so much damn time doing it. Because the other thing about Twitch, if you want to grow, one of the best ways to grow on Twitch is just to be funny when you're offline. So being in other people's Twitch streams and just being like cracking jokes and
so the other more work.
Yeah. So like Twitch streamers who do really well are the ones who spend an additional 4 hours networking, not networking in like the traditional sense, but just being there, being present. And people were like, oh, I've heard of you. I'm going to hit the follow button. Oh, you were that guy who said that funny thing. I'm going to watch you. And it happens that way. And Twitch has built itself around that with raiding and hosts and a lot of mechanics that are official mechanics in the website now, but are things that sprang up from when it was just in TV.
Yeah.
Like a raid, if you don't know, is when you finish your stream, everyone who's watching you to all pile in on somebody else's stream.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So you all come across. So
that's what you want to be happening, basically, constantly.
Yeah. So you raid them and then hopefully they raid you back another time and everyone benefits. It's very much it should be a rising tide raises all boats kind of website. It's changed a lot now. It's had to evolve, and being bought out by Amazon means that there's a lot more pressure on Twitch to make money, which is never a good thing. Like, if all you can think about is how you're going to earn a dollar, it means that you're only trying to think of things that earn a dollar, and often success in life comes from accidentally earning a dollar while you're doing something you enjoy.
It's true. How do you think, or do you ever think about how social media has changed from the Pip days, we're talking MySpace, to now with things like Twitch, TikTok,
all those kind of things. Do you think the workload for people has intensified? Do you think the need to be constantly seen has intensified?
That I don't think it's intensified. I think that things have died and been replaced by other things. Like the Dan and Pip era, you were a big part of it with forums. You would be like, although forums aren't really a thing anymore, you've still got Reddit and that. And that is all about being present in a community. But like TikTok might seem new, but it's just fine, you know?
Yeah, it's true.
And literally when Musical.ly was launched, which is what TikTok is, it's the, just rebranded Musical.ly, it was pitched as a replacement to Vine. So it is literally Vine. So I don't think that we're in a place where you've got more places you have to be. I just think we're in a place where you have to be more thoughtful about how you treat each place. Like, Facebook is awful. It's just an awful website, badly laid out, and it's not worth your time unless you're a brand willing to put money into it.
Yeah.
But because of that, the way people talk on there is different. Like, you have to understand that the way people engage on there is like kids in the schoolyard. Even your gran is dunking on people on Facebook, you know. So you have to go in there knowing that people are going to say shitty things for the dumbest reasons, but also that this isn't worth your time. Just put the basics of your energy in there and see if you can create or iterate somewhere else, you know. Like, if you're a musician, Facebook's not a good place for you, but Instagram's fucking great.
Yeah.
Like, being able to, if you can find a way of making cool little video clips to show your work, to show your workings, to show things developing, people engage with that. People are interested. You know?
It's interesting. Do you think that it's difficult to stand out on any of these social medias because of the vast quantity that there is on there?
I think that's true of life, though.
Yeah, yeah.
I think it's just it's very difficult to stand out, especially as the ways in which we stand out very rarely are the person we are. Sean Adams, the founder of Drowned in Sound, just a couple of days ago wrote a blog on the Music Union about how bands are using social media and how you should approach it and stuff.
Yeah.
And it's all about finding your audience, like knowing your audience and finding your tone and all these things. And it's great. Everything he says in that article is 100% correct.
I have to give it a read.
But I hate it.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because a lot of the ways to succeed using social media is about painting a picture rather than being who you are.
Genuine, you know? Yeah.
Which is the same with music. Like, if you want to succeed on Spotify, don't make your music. Make music that fits with the Spotify algorithm.
That's it.
You know? Yeah, it can be a little frustrating. I also do believe that social media gives far more opportunities than you could ever expect. The amount of things that, even with the Dan and Pip stuff, that have happened because of a Twitter conversation, you know, are huge. Like, well, we got signed in America because of a MySpace post, you know.
Do you think there's an element of it's almost raised the opportunities you can find, but diminished the value of music, the actual money value of music?
Yeah, like, music's no longer the product. Music is no longer the product of the music industry. And until either the music industry is burnt to the ground and we rebuild it around music as the product, or we realize that, we're going to get nowhere. Like, music isn't the product. The story you tell is the product for press, and basically the actual product is getting people to subscribe to Spotify, sadly.
Yeah.
You know? So, yeah, it's it is very different. But that is human nature as well. Like, we are very much... Why do we like celebrity news? Why do we like all that stuff? It's nothing to do with the music or the movies they're in. It's about wanting to feel connected with people.
Of course. And it's like, interesting. I'd even say that the change towards storytelling being what sold music started before social media, with like the artists we were using for record sleeves and things like that, selling records just by how they looked as opposed to the music that was within them.
But we talk about clickbait a lot, you know, like, but we had clickbait before the internet existed. You know, what a newspaper put on its front cover was its clickbait.
Yeah.
You know, we've been doing this a long time. This, the way the world is right now, is a result of the way we have interacted with it. It's not like some aberrant behavior of the internet springing up accidentally. It's the internet evolving to fit how we use it. So yeah, this is why I'm very, I don't want to say negative, but when I see people talking about how we're gonna fix the music industry, I can't really engage with it, because the reason it's broken is because of us. It's because of us, the users, the listeners, the audience and creators. It's broken because we wanted it to be, even though we didn't realize that. So how do we fix it? Because, you know, you got to convince a hell of a lot of people. You want Spotify to change how they pay artists? You need to convince every artist to stop putting their music on Spotify. Ain't gonna happen. You're gonna need to convince people who have been told that all the music in the world is worth $9.99 a month, that that's incorrect. That's not gonna happen. Yeah. You know?
It's true. Considering the finance aspect of music, which we've talked about, what is it that then fuels you to revolve your life around creating music?
I like it.
That's a great answer. It's a great answer.
It's the only thing I'm good at. It's the only thing I know that I'm going to enjoy. Even when I'm frustrated with my inability to get my hands to do what I want them to do, like, no, it's good. Like, I genuinely enjoy making it. It's a direct reflection of, like, my emotions, which, as a man, you're not meant to show your emotions. So it helps them on that psychological level. But
can you trace that back to a specific memory or a specific time when music meant that to you?
Like, really, no. But I think, yes, kind of. Music's always been around me. Yet, not, like, my parents weren't big music lovers. They listened to the same, like, three albums over and over again. So, but, yeah, there's just something in it, you know. I remember being, like, 14 and listening to a Carpenters album on my dad's big headphones and being fascinated by it. Like, all the, like, the Carpenters aren't a seminal, important thing in my life, but there was something about, oh, that's, why is that sound all the way over there? And, like, how can that sound like it's in front of me, even though the sound's coming from the sides and all that? Just the fascination with the interpretation of noise.
Yeah.
You know, that's the thing that fascinates me. Like, the meme is that music is just wobbly air. And it is, but it's wobbly air vibrating a bone in your head and your brain thinking, that's what that sounds like. Have a listen to this. And it's like, how does your brain even interpret that width and depth of frequencies? It blows my mind. And I really like fucking with it, basically.
It's amazing. And I find it incredible to hear people talk with a passion about music, because often people wonder why why so many people stop making music. There's so many bands break up when people then take full-time jobs. Why? And I think a lot of the time it's because being in a band seems really cool when you're young. But if you don't have the passion that you just showed when asked that question, then it's going to be difficult to carry on because there's a lot of bullshit involved.
Yeah, there's so much shit. There's so much, like, garbage that gets in your way. Even just, like, the mundane stuff of, like, when you release songs, you need to register them on all the different songwriter databases. And it takes time and it sucks the life out of you. And with bands as well, I think people forget that, in a sense, like, all human interaction are like chemical reactions. Like some people bond, some people trigger each other to explode, sort of thing. And bands are very much about that chemical reaction. And when the band ends, it's so difficult to find that again, that energy. You know, like, I don't know how I would be able to write with another rapper, like, because I need someone who is stubborn enough to not take shit from me, but at the same time respects me enough to know when I'm right. And I had that in Pip, but yeah, I've not really met anyone else who either doesn't overplay their own worth or overplay my worth.
Yeah, no, absolutely, absolutely, Dan. And it's something that I talk to my partner a lot about because once the last band I was in broke up, I started doing solo stuff. And partly due to the fact that I find as I got older, it became more difficult to try and find people that I'd want to spend that much time with and that I'd want to actually, like, you know what writing music's like. You get into arguments with people. You have to have a mutual respect whilst being willing to dive into something that can be quite a difficult journey.
Mm.
And it's not that easy to have the energy to find those people over and over again, I don't think.
Yeah, no, I agree.
What about the latest record, Scattershot, going back to that full circle? Because I think it's a nice way to maybe bring the conversation to an end. Is there equipment that you used in that was new to what you've been doing, or have you tried to keep it the same for the last few EPs?
I would say there's new things in the last three EPs. I'm using a hell of a lot more tape, awesome. Like cassette tape, four tracks. I can see literal pile of four tracks in the corner of the room right now. I'm using a lot more guitar pedals. To build sounds because they're so instant rather than the thing with a VST. Oh, I need a distortion. Oh, look, I've got 800 different VST distortions and each of those have 800 different presets, you know. So, like, there's a lot of that more instantaneous grabbing of things. The only real thing that was new was I've got a synth called a Lyra 8. Which is a Russian, they call it an organismic synthesizer.
Okay.
But yeah, it's a very, very Russian synthesizer. it works on, it's got little metal plates that, like, you have to basically be the circuit closing device with your fingers. And, but then all the notes you play are used, how would I describe this? Music harmonizes by slotting together, and it's almost like you're doubling.
Okay.
Whereas this is like taking two frequencies and then making them multiply each other. So it's creates very uncomfortable soundscapes and feedbacky. Very aggressive synthesizer. You can use for gentle things, but use that a fair amount. There's a VST, not a VST, there's an iOS app called Mononoke.
Mononoke.
Mononoke. Which is almost the same as this Lyra 8, but actually a little prettier. But yes, I think it's like a fiver on iOS, and it's an amazing little drone machine.
I think it's really cool that you've mentioned a few times now how affordable some of the equipment that you've used at times is. Is there something you'd recommend if people want to get into making the kind of music you make, that you'd say, right, you can start with this and it's really affordable and easy to get into?
That's a big question, because although it's all affordable, I've got a lot of stuff.
Of course.
My real honest answer is that you already have it. Like, most people have a tablet. Like, especially if you haven't really made electronic music before, just get on some of the iOS audio forums and look at the vastness of synthesizers and all that people are making in the virtual tablet realm, because they're so cheap and they're so powerful. And like, what always scares me with electronic music is people sit down and, oh, I'm going to do this, so I need a 2 grand Mac, and I need to buy Ableton, and I need these VSTs, or I need Massive X, and I need this. And before they know it, they've spent 5 grand before they've even written a note. And
absolutely.
If you've got, it's not cheap on iPad, but if you've got 40 quid, there's Korg, the synth manufacturers, have a thing called Gadget. Korg Gadget. And you know what? You could record a full band in that. It's like GarageBand, but better. Like, you can make multiple tracks. You've got loads of virtual synths in there. You've got all the Korg classic synths in there. And, yeah, it's a fully featured studio for 40 quid. You can even get it on Nintendo Switch.
What? That's awesome. That's so cool.
Like, and, yeah, that would be a far better place to start than to blow a load of money on actual physical things. If you've got a phone, iPhone at the moment, but launching on Android later in the year, like, you can download Endless with 3 S's for free, and you can jam out beats and crazy loops and stuff on that just instantly, and you can then share them with a room full of random people across the world, and they can iterate on what you just made, and then you can iterate on what they made. You know, there's far better ways to be thinking about starting making music than, yeah, I need to buy this expensive thing.
Yeah,
obviously, if you need to learn how to play guitar, then you're screwed. You have to buy the thing. But electronic music, you already own it.
I think a lot of the time people get caught up on equipment because it's nice to buy stuff, and it looks pretty, and it's nice to have this dream wish list. But at the end of the day, a lot of the time, if you wanted to be making music, you'd be making it with what you've got. You wouldn't be waiting for that equipment.
The thing I mentioned, Massive there. Massive is a virtual synth that everyone in the entire world has heard, because it's the sound of basically from 2004 through to 2016, maybe. It's all of dubstep, the majority of trap, the majority of just any dance music has used Massive in some way, shape, or form. It's a very powerful synthesizer, and it's just complex yet really easy to use. So, like, there are things you might end up wanting to buy. There are things that maybe make it easier to make that particular sound, but ultimately, if you are invested emotionally, if you're invested time wise you'll find a way of doing it. Like, you'll find a way of making that sound. And if you can't quite make that sound, maybe you make a sound that sounds better along the way anyway. Maybe, like, you stumble in and go, oh, that's nice, and, you know.
And I also think by just trying to get as close as you can without the actual equipment, it means that if you ever do get that equipment, you'll be so much better at using it.
Yeah, I think so.
It's interesting, because I find that a lot of the time when you want something and you end up getting it, it's a long learning curve to actually be good at it. It's not as easy as just buying your dream synth and being able to play around with it and sound good as quickly as you want. So it's you're almost putting off the creative process continuously by wanting to keep upgrading the equipment as opposed to just learning to use what you've got.
That's the thing, like, I'm the worst for knowing the overview of how a thing works and not actually fully understanding everything in it. Like, the amount of times I'll see someone using something I own and they're, like, making this wild sound with it, and I'm like, how? Bullshit. This is bullshit. You're lying. But it makes me go back and look at that thing and go, oh, so they were doing, oh, that's clever. Oh, isn't that clever? Isn't that really clever? Well done. I've been using the same core software since, God, 2005, I think, I got Ableton. Maybe longer. I still don't know what half of it does.
Of course, yeah.
I just learn the things when I need to learn it. You know, the most important musical instrument in my life is Google. Right. Google, how do I do this? I actually can. Or I just click that button. Oh, that's clever.
Do you purposefully try and get out of, like, creative comfort almost of using the same settings? Do you try and push yourself to try new things each time?
I think you know what works. I think, like, there are things that you're always going to do because they're always going to sound nice to you. I am always going to put too much delay on certain things, and delay as in the effect, not delay as in latency. I'm always going to do, there's certain sounds I like. There's certain ways of tuning synthesizers, well, just not tuning them usually, that I like. So they're always going to be those things, but it does definitely, like, there's a book. Hang on, what's it called? It's by Dennis DeSantis. I can see it. Hang on, I'm going to move away from the mic a second. 74 Creative Strategies for Electronic Musicians. It's a hardback book sold by Ableton, written by Dennis DeSantis.
Oh, cool.
Currently available as a free download on the Ableton website. See, I don't work for Ableton. But,
you should.
Yeah, they're giving it away for free at the moment because of quarantine and helping people be creative and stuff. But one of the things in that book it talks about is how, like I said, 74 different ideas to help you, not technically, but, like, philosophically.
Okay.
Get through things, you know. So if you feel like you're writing the same song over and over again, say you are, like, an EDM producer, you are going to be writing in the same tempo, similar key, all that, and you feel tired or bored of that, the only way to change that is to actively change it. So if you go into your last five songs and make a note of the beats per minute and pay attention to what synthesizers you were using and what key you were in and all that, write all those things down and then not allow yourself to do that. You know, okay, I'm not allowed to use that synth. I'm not allowed to use that BPM. I'm not allowed to use this. You can get yourself around it. You can find new ways of working. There will be things that you always do and you can't not do.
Of course.
But you have to actively get yourself into another place. Now, for me, obviously, I've never had a genre. So, you know, that's why it's called Scattershot. I my entire career is a mess. Like, every Dan and Pip album, like, what genre were they? Like, the hip-hop part. Yeah. Was there, but, like, there's dubstep, there's drum and bass, there's traditional hip hop, but then there's, like, atmospheric soundtrack stuff. There's even one track that is literally just a synth out of tune burbling, but it fit, you know.
That's amazing. I think it's a nice way to be, though, because it's quite often that I think. When we look at some of the best records of throughout history, the bands that were producing them didn't always stick to one genre. And I feel like as press got bigger with music and as social media came in, we're almost forced to try and fit into one niche and have one type of sound. And I think the bands that generally do best are able to do a variety of music and yeah, do it well.
But my problem with it is that we, as listeners, write people off really quickly. So you hear one song by a particular band, and that is what they sound like to you forever. So this is the thing I'm coming up against now. I am 12 releases into my career. The sound of Scattershot is not the sound of anything Dan and Pitt did, anything I did before 2019. Yet there's people who heard Thou Shalt Always Kill, thought it was shit, and will never ever in my life click it, even if they would absolutely love it, but because it's, oh, that's that guy. So this is something I've been thinking about a lot lately. It's like whether artists should, when they evolve, maybe change their name. It's like change, call thing, different things, if you know what I mean. So that people don't come in with baggage, and people who wrote you off as one thing maybe come back and find you as this new thing. The problem is we're so damn reliant on social media that you can't. Like, I don't know, what have I got on, like, Twitter? Like, 20,000, 30,000 people? I would feel weird, like, trying to set up a fresh Twitter
start
account.
Start from scratch, yeah.
And go, hey, guys, this is Drum and Bass Dan, and this is Ambient Dan, and this is, you know?
Yeah,
but,
no, absolutely.
But maybe, like, Danbient, as an artist, would do well if people didn't know that, or didn't instantly know that it was Dan Lesac.
I think it's a really weird one, Dan, because I think that as human beings we like fresh starts, and it's a really healthy thing, but I think that we don't do it because of the social media element to it. And you know, I played in lots of punk bands, and I've seen so many bands that were headlining festivals then start other projects because that band broke up and have like 300 followers, and it's heartbreaking sometimes watching them tour to a half empty room, going from headlining festivals to half empty rooms. But that is how social media works. If people aren't seeing it, they don't know about it.
Yeah,
it's very strange.
Yeah, it's frustrating, but ultimately I suppose you have to be aware.
Yeah.
You have to be aware that that is the way it's going to work. And, like, it all comes down to what your goal is at the end. Like, I would like to survive on music alone, but that's not going to happen again. You know, I've not been able to do that for years, and it's a shame, and it's really frustrating, but it just means that I have to take more joy in the times I do get to make music. I have to take more joy in, you know, when a person buys something, you know. So, and if that means I have to take photography jobs and shit to get through, then I will. I don't like it. I don't want to do it. But, you know.
But, you know, it's weird because I'm not sure if it was the same for yourself, but for me, growing up, it seemed so rock and roll to be that band in the back of a dirty van on tour the whole time. As you get older, that's not that glamorous. But for me personally, it wasn't always the rich rock stars that I was looking up to. It was the cool rock lifestyle that actually, when you evaluate it, isn't always either healthy or good for you or does well financially.
It's interesting you say that, because we didn't get our break until I was 27, I think. 27, 28 maybe. So I'd like worked. I'd worked. I'd managed a fucking HMV. Myself, like HMV manager out on the road. So, like, you know, like, I'd live the mundanity. stuff for a long time. And I think that I was more willing to chill. And Pip's like lazy. I mean, very relaxed. He's not a big partier. So neither of us were that crazy. The weird thing was, is that we always ended up with people around us who were like living large. Like we had a sound man for a number of years who was just like, dude, what are you doing? Calm the fuck down. Like there was one band, I'm not going to say their name, but we toured with early on, and they took every opportunity for the freedom to kick in. And it's like, it's cool and all, and it's great, but they came away from that tour like in debt and all that, because they just pissed it away on bags and booze. And we were like biding our time as such. And I do think we got to have far more enjoyable experiences because we were boring. Like,
I can understand that 100%, because it wrecks you like physically as well, partying that hard, and then the actual stage time, because it's exhausting.
That's funny, yeah, because I only really drank on stage. I would come off some nights and it was like, how have I drunk so much? Because you're like hot and sweating, and the booze doesn't hit you until you come off stage and you're like, I'm hammered. Yeah. I found this towards the end of my career. I found this cherry bourbon.
Okay.
With like Pepsi, and it was just like cherry Coke, but alcoholic and banging. And I'd get through far too much of that.
Yeah.
The dumb thing is, I've still got booze in the cupboard from touring, because we drank so little, but it would always appear on the rider. And like every time I get a chance to give someone a bottle of booze, I do. Yeah, I've still got, I must have like 5 or 6 bottles of rum.
That's just so still funny.
You know, the weird thing, actually weirder than that, I realised that I've got a couple of bottles of original recipe Sailor Jerry's.
Oh, no way.
And they go for like loads of money.
Yeah.
I'm going to spend.
They were way nicer as well. The butterscotch, I call it the butterscotch Sailor Jerry's.
Yeah. So mate Tim runs a bar, owns a bar, sold a bar. Actually, did he sell that recently? He did sell it recently. He found a brand called Old J, which is very close to the original Sailor Jerry's recipe.
I'll have to check that out.
So, yeah, check that out.
That might make me a very happy man, because it's been a long time since... I was definitely a kid when someone was like, you'll like Sailor Jerry's, I'm pretty sure.
It's good shit.
It was.
I haven't drunk in a year, I don't think. I can't remember last time I had a drink. Maybe I had some sake a little while ago, but yeah, I don't really drink outside of restaurants.
That's a good way to do it. It's a good way to do it. Food and alcohol can be nice.
Yeah, like a beer with your curry, some sake with your sushi.
Dan, I have had such a great chat. Thank you so much for giving me your time.
No worries.
Anything you would like to leave our listeners with? Any links, any websites that you want them to check out?
Well, the music's on danlasak.bandcamp.com. The podcast is just Falling Forward with Dan Lasak in your favourite pod catcher. And yeah, come watch me be grumpy on Twitter at Dan Lasak.
I will leave all the links in the description as well, so people can get to it easily. And thank you so much, Dan.
No worries, man, no worries.
So there you have it, the conversation with Dan Lasak. What an absolute privilege. And it really was getting to chat to someone who I remember going to watch when I was younger, and the show absolutely blowing my mind, changing my whole concept of the music that I could create, and the music I liked as well, and cross genres that I wasn't even aware were a thing. And yeah, just getting to chat to him, and the fact that he's been such a big part of my life from then on, which sounds weird to say, but I think when you find musicians who you're always anticipating what they're going to release next, and you're always looking forward to it and eager to hear it, it kind of becomes a big part of
the soundtrack to your life, quite literally. And that has definitely been the case with a lot of what Dan Lesac has released. So yeah, I hope you enjoyed that. If you did, go check out a load of the other episodes on the podcast. Some of my personal favourites, talking to Gabe from Braille, talking to Carlos Lastra, the skater, the conversation I had with Jack Hutchcraft from Waco, who's also an amazing writer. That was amazing. The episode I did on neurodevelopment with Nikki McGlynn, it's really, really interesting as well. I super enjoyed that. What else? I talked to Pete Wright, the drummer for Ducking Punches, and we talked about meditation, yoga, punk rock. That was amazing. So yeah, as I said at the start, now I am back to focusing on some personal projects. Really excited to have some conversations with people that I've been looking forward to chatting to. If you've got anyone you think I should chat to, anyone you'd like to see on the podcast that you'd like me to at least try and reach out to, get in touch. And if you don't have someone to recommend and you'd just like to get in touch anyway, that would be awesome too. I would love to hear from you, and I will catch you soon.